Chapter 13, Rio de Janeiro.
Tell me about the revolution you covered in Rio.
When NBC cabled me to get myself to Rio de Janeiro just as fast as possible, because the revolution was in progress, I had something like 3 hours from the time I got the cable to the time I was at the airport and boarding the plane. There were frequent flights from Buenos Aires to Rio, and I caught the first one out. When I got to Rio, it was, when the plane landed first in Sao Paulo, and the airport was ringed with armed soldiers, everyone in readiness to shoot. We didn't get off the plane after a few passengers who were getting off in Sao Paulo got off. The plane went on to Rio. It was the same scene in Rio. I didn't have much time to catch up on all this. So I went out into the streets and just kind of milled around trying to get the flavor of what was going on. It was a strange scene, actually, because the revolution essentially was over. It was a coup d'etat by the military, and the president, Jango Goulart, was on the run. We didn't know exactly where he was at that point. As it turned out later, he had gotten down to Puerto Alegre and on into Uruguay for safekeeping. In Rio, there was what basically was kind of like a carnival celebration. I saw ticker tape and confetti being thrown from windows. People were out in the street dancing. There was no rational explanation for this because the military had overthrown the democratic government. But nevertheless, that was the scene. I went back to my hotel and then rapidly put it together into a commentary piece for Emphasis, which was the big commentary radio program that ran over weekends in conjunction with the Monitor, sent it off. It turned out very, very well because I had really captured, just by being there and wandering around and talking as well as I could to people in the streets, I got the flavor, I think, down pretty good. Well, NBC apparently thought so too. It ended up on Emphasis almost immediately. And later, NBC published a book of what they called The Best of Emphasis, and my piece on Brazil's revolution was among those with far better known names than me. To do the story completely, I had to go to Brasilia, which was the capital of Brazil. Brasilia, at the time, had just been finished. Beautiful buildings and hardly anyone there. But the offices of the legislature and the offices of the presidency were there and were declared the place to conduct business. So the new government of Brazil would fly in, the legislators would fly in from Rio in the morning, conduct their business, and fly out in the afternoon or evening back to Rio to their homes. The handful of reporters who were there, me included, stayed at a hotel, the only hotel in Brasilia at the time. I had a little Volkswagen rental driving over these exquisite new roads that had been built, and I was the only vehicle on them. There was virtually no one there. The United States, all embassies had to be there because that was the capital. The United States Embassy in Brasilia had a total of 12 people in it.
Oh my God.
The consulate of the United States in Rio, where all the business was done, had more than 200 people in it. That's how the United States and other governments conducted their business. My stay in Brasilia was about a week. During this period of time, NBC sent down reinforcements. Robert McNeil to some, known mostly from his association with the McNeil-Lehrer report on PBS later. Robin and I covered Brasilia together, and nothing much exciting happened. I continued to do monitor where I could, because that always was a moneymaker. And on one occasion, I drove out to Annapolis, some 30 or 40 miles outside of Brasilia, where many, many years before, Janet Gaynor, the silent motion picture star, had built a home and had settled there. And Mary Martin was a good friend of Gaynor's, and somehow she became enchanted with this place. And I rode down to Annapolis to where Mary Martin's home was. She was in residence there at the time. She and her husband, the producer Leland Hayward, I went down there to see if I couldn't do a monitor interview with Mary Martin about where they live. Well, Leland Hayward entertained me. He simply said Mary was indisposed and couldn't do the interview. But he wanted to talk to me. This wasn't a monitor interview because he wasn't a big enough name for monitor. We talked about this whole setup that he had down there. He was delighted to talk about that. But the reason why he wanted to talk to me was because I had more information on what was going on in the revolution, the Brazilian revolution, than he could get anywhere else. So I supplied him with a lot of news, and he told me about this egg operation, chicken farm that they had down there, whereby they were producing eggs for the community in Annapolis. They were selling eggs. I don't know. It certainly wasn't a big money maker. I don't know that it was a money maker at all. But this was a business that they were involved in at the time.
How did you get unprocessed film for the TV stories out of Brazil to New York?
Well, it was the same way in Buenos Aires before Brazil. The routine was simple. These were the days before satellites and instant communication. Stories for television, video, was done on film, motion picture film, either sound striped or worked another way. And you went out with a cameraman and did a story, and you ended up with a 100-foot roll of film, unprocessed, that you had to get to New York immediately because of the time frame, deadlines on getting on the air. Compared to today, it's a cumbersome process, but it was the best we could do then. And even if you saw something 24 hours later, it was still exciting if you hadn't seen it and you were aware of a tragedy or a disaster or whatever. The routine was fairly simple. I'd take that film and go immediately to the airport for a flight that was going to New York. In those days, there were quite a few airlines that were flying to New York, and I'd find me an American passenger. I'd talk to him, tell him who I was, show him my credentials. I was obviously not looking to do any harm, but this was also before the terror days, and everybody was much, much looser. You never checked anything getting on a plane. You just came out of the waiting lounge and onto the ramp. I'd find somebody going to New York and tell him who I was, show them what I had for NBC in New York, all clearly labeled NBC, and would offer him $10 to simply take it with him on the plane, that there would be somebody, when he got off the plane, there to receive it, holding a big sign up with his name. So all he had to do was just walk over to the man, give him the film, and that was the courier for NBC who would take it to Rockefeller Center and have it processed immediately for air. That was how it was done.
There's another good story that I didn't know that I thought was pretty entertaining. The story of how Ampex was founded, Al Capstaff.
All of the people at Monitor were friends with me. I couldn't have had the enormous success I had it not been for the close friendship I had with all of the upper echelon, from the producer on down, of Monitor. Al Capstaff was the senior producer of Monitor. And Al had been the producer of Bing Crosby's Kraft Music Hall, a fairly successful show. Al told some wonderful stories, and the one I really liked the most was the story of Ampex. Ampex made recording equipment. They made the first really usable tape recorders. And how this all came about was because of a GI at the end of World War II, when they overran one of the German cities, saw this strange machine. I believe it was a Telefunken machine. And he dismantled it and put it in his knapsack and brought it back. This, if I can remember the guy's, the GI's name correctly, it was Pontiff. And he came back with this machine and in a garage reconstructed it. He recognized it for what it was. And there were 10 or 12 spools of tape that was in this studio that he brought along back with him. One of the reasons he was aware of the potential of this machine was because he was well aware that during the war, Adolf Hitler would make speeches from various places that obviously was live, not recorded. It wasn't a recording. And they'd bomb the bejesus out of that place. And Hitler was somewhere else. Pontiff figured out this was a recording device that made it sound live. Brought it back, reconstructed it in a garage. And I don't know how the connection with Bing Crosby took place, but this is how Capstaff was in on all what had originally taken place. But Crosby was invited to a demonstration of this machine that Pontiff had rigged up. And Crosby was fascinated. He was trying to figure out how he could get out of the grind of doing an hour show live. If there was some way where just bits and pieces of it could be done live and the rest of it could be recorded, this was worth a fortune to Crosby. And so Crosby established Ampex. That's how the Ampex was founded. And some years later, he sold his holdings in Ampex. And Ampex went on to glorious days. One of the funny stories about that original tape machine was they only had these 10 tapes. And the splices for editing became so great that they became almost unusable. And that's how Minnesota Mining got involved, 3M, in producing tape. They got one of the tapes and was told, copy it, you guys. Wow. And they did.
Tell me about how recording was done before the Ampex machine.
Prior to this time, all recording was done on vinyl discs, except that there now was something new introduced, a wire recorder. The wire recorder was certainly more portable than a machine that could engrave the vinyl discs, but the quality was not that good. It was scratchy. Nevertheless, wire recorders were used extensively in World War II by the Allies. And as far as I know, anybody who could lay their hands on one, it was a barely acceptable substitute.
I wanted you to talk about the Tipuani gold mine, too.
One of the most interesting stories I ever did was for the Today Show. There was a gold mine operation in Bolivia at Tipuani. And on assignment from the Today Show, Pedro Torres, my cameraman in Brazil, and I were sent to Tipuani to do a feature on gold mining.
How far away was that?
We're in Rio de Janeiro. We have to fly to La Paz, Bolivia. We have to fly from La Paz, Bolivia to Tipuani, a trip of about 3 hours on a DC-3 that had a dirt landing field. The entry to this dirt landing field, number one, the whole area was just shrouded in fog. And the only way you could see your way into the airfield was to go between two mountain peaks, and the plane had to turn sideways to go through to feel safe about clearance. And that was how you flew to Tipuani. We flew in a DC-3, which was the aircraft, the only aircraft that came and went from this airfield. It brought people in, took people out, took gold out, and that was the only way to get there. It was in the midst of jungle. Overland was an impossible route. And in this town of Tipuani, there were about 200 gold miners who lived in total isolation and got paid extraordinarily well for mining in the river. And they had a tunnel under the river, which was how they got the gold in and out. It was a very, very primitive operation, but big time in terms of the amount of gold they were producing. Pedro and I stayed in Tipuani for about 5 days, I think it was. We got a wonderful story. We shot the thing from almost every angle imaginable. They had a guardhouse where the gold was kept with one constable guarding it. There never was much fear of theft in Tipuani because there was no way out.
Makes sense.
When it became time for me to leave, I went into the guardhouse.
You were there at Carnival.
And we poured through sacks and sacks of gold dust for gold nuggets. And I bought them. I think the price of gold at the time was $32 an ounce. And because I was at the wholesale level, I bought them at $31 an ounce. Pedro bought some gold, too. I gave everybody gold nuggets. You got gold nuggets. I had a massive gold nugget that I gave to my mother for the 50th anniversary. It was a half a carat, a half an ounce.
Wow.
One of the most interesting experiences, aside from this doing the story, was Saturday night in Tipuani. There was one bar that was not stocked until Saturday with beer, cans of beer. And Saturday night was revelry night in Tipuani at the gold mine. All of those miners just got stinking, stinking drunk. And in the morning, I wandered by there, and there were sprawled bodies all over the floor on top of beer can after beer can after beer. There was a bed of beer cans and a few bodies on top of it. That was the end of my stay in Tipuani. But one of the funny stories I heard while I was there is that an enterprising man figured out that he could make a fortune by bringing three women as whores, as prostitutes, into Tipuani. The only women who were in Tipuani were the wives of some men who were there. He thought he could make a fortune. So he brought in these three dames, And in 1 week, he was out of business. They all got married. I've been to Carnival in Rio twice, and once in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Actually, you know, it wasn't Cochabamba. It was Santa Cruz. This was an oil town. Dirt roads, booming, ramshackle buildings, a couple of bars, a couple of hotels, a real Barbary Coast. Since we were there on Carnival, we were invited to the big community party at the community center. This was different from any party I've ever been anywhere in the world before or since. The custom in this town was for the women to be all disguised. Their costume was to have a pillowcase over their head with holes where the eyes belong, and they could drink by lifting the pillowcase up to their lips and drink that way. They could talk because there was nothing obstructing their speech. And the custom was, this was the one night of the year that the women could be incognito, that the men were never to know who was who. And there was a lot of lovemaking that took place later on that night. And I'm told that the women never divulged who they were. Who's the head under the pillowcase? The carnivals in Rio were much more realistic. Carnival in Rio is a much different thing, much more sane in a lot of ways, insane in a lot of others. But this was the great tradition of this famous city. I've seen Carnival in Rio twice. The first time was with Gracia, my second wife. Carnival in those days, before they built the big amphitheater and viewing stands, concrete, Carnival in Rio in the early days was simply wooden stands were constructed along the main drag of the city, and the march took place through the city in a long stream. And people lined the streets to watch from the streets, and them who had the money could pay for a box of the constructed seating. Gracia and I bought tickets for a box, and we watched Carnival from there. The best thing, well, Carnival was wonderful. Easily far more impressive than when I saw it later in the amphitheater. This was much more natural. I mean, the streets were alive. You were in the heart of the city, not in the theater. Getting into the stands was through a mob scene. We had to go through a turnstile to get to our box. And I remember we were just pushed and shoved. And by the time we got to the box, we sat down, we were comfortable. Suddenly, I realized my pant leg was wet, and I smelled brandy. I had a pouch, a leather pouch that I had carried, and in it was a plastic flask of brandy. What had happened, and my passport was in that pouch as well. What had happened was, in the scuffling of getting in, somebody with a razor knife, a box cutter, I guess you might say, early use of it, lifted my pouch and slashed it from the inside, thinking they would remove items from the inside. Well, it was thick leather, and they cut a serious 4 or 5 inch gash in the pouch, which would have taken quite a few stitches in my leg had it been there in place of the pouch. But they were after the pouch and what was in it and got nothing. But they had slashed the brandy. And I ended up having to put the brandy on the side so on the where the cut was, it wouldn't continue leaking. And eventually the pant leg dried, and all I was left with was the smell. The other time I saw Carnival was part of an assignment I was doing for a travel story. And I was with a travel group, and we were all taken care of very carefully. We had box seats in the concrete stands, and the Carnival Parade, of course, was spectacular, but none of the flavor that I remembered it could have. So Carnival has a very soft spot in my heart.
Talk about the music scene in Rio.
Bossa Nova was just beginning when I went to Brazil. Black Orpheus had come out in 1962 or the beginning of 1963, and the music of Antonio Carlos Jobim was electrifying. The world suddenly paid notice to the samba rhythms and the whole new concept of how to put jazz along with it. And that was exciting to me because I had been to the premiere of Black Orpheus before I went to Rio that opened the San Francisco Film Festival. I was tremendously excited about the music possibilities when I wasn't busy with news. And some excellent musicians were there. And on Sundays, they used to have a jam session at a bar in the Copacabana called the Bottoms Up. And I would fall in there on Sundays, every Sunday, regularly, have a few drinks and listen to these great young musicians. And these guys were all really, really good. After several Sundays, when it became difficult to, the place was packed, to find a place, there were several tables just in front of the dance floor. And one of them was a very small table even for two. I got to know the bartender, and I slipped him the equivalent of $5 for him to put a reserve sign on that table. And from that point on, for how many weeks or months, that was my table for the Sunday jam session at the Bottoms Up. Paul Winter came into town, flautist. And I met him, I think, at the Bottoms Up, and I invited him to sit at my table. Almost nobody ever got invited to sit at my table with me. And Winter and I became pretty chummy. For the period he was there, it was a period of 3 weeks to a month. We saw a great deal of each other, and we went around hunting where good music was being played. We had generally a pretty good time, and Paul was the one who turned me on to a great music store that was out of the way in Rio, where I ended up buying percussion instruments that were used for the carnival parades and in Bossa Nova and in samba music. I got a whole collection of wonderful basic instruments, and they were all so cheap because this is where the poor Brazilian musicians went to get instruments, and the collection of instruments were nothing like anything you would see in a music store in the United States. Those all came back with me, and I have a carton of them sitting in my garage, which at some point in the very near future, Stephanie is going to pick up and take to her home. That's where they belong.
Yeah, good.
This concludes Chapter 13.